Now they say, all right, now this group over here, you have all those, you know, on your little slip, there's building 12, you get in this area over here, all over here, and on your higher end slip, this is building 4, you go over here, they're the fabricating people. Building 12 is the assembly people. And then the bus would be outside, everybody loaded on the bus, and they'd take us up there to the building, mm-hmm. you see? Mm-hmm. And so I don't recall making friends with anyone, acquaintances, when I was hiring in those 3 days. Mm-hmm. You'd think you'd make a lifelong friendship, you know, but... it was a very confused situation down there.
But you come in, you would get into Building 12.
I'd come into Building 12, and they'd take us to our general foreman. He, in turn, would take us to a senior lead man. And a senior lead man would take, like myself, and say, all right, now, Betty, this is Bill, and I think I got the fellow's name, and they're going to take you over on the job and show you how to shoot a rivet. Mm-hmm. That's it. Mm-hmm. Mm.
And was your first day full 8 hours?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, it was.
And what were you told about things like... the wages, the services, raises, do you recall the
situation? Oh, yes, well, they discussed that with us when we were going through that 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
Not how long, but they told us, you know, that there wasn't any union out there, and that we had a dispensary, so if you were ill, but there weren't insurance benefits, there weren't any benefits or anything like that, nothing whatever. You would just be getting so much an hour, and that's it,
mm-hmm.
you see? But there was a dispensary if you became ill on the job.
And there were no other services?
No services at all. Nothing.
And
nothing.
What about, did they tell you what the step increases would be?
Yes, yes. They did tell us that every 16 weeks you would be entitled to a review.
Mm-hmm.
And if you pass the review, then you'd be given a merit increase of 2.5 cents. So after 16 weeks, that 2.5 cents, if you didn't get that half, you'd have to wait for the next 16 weeks, you know. And it went on like that. And, you know, I really remember, the job fascinated me. I just really liked it. In fact, I progressed pretty darn fast. After I became a riveter, then they saw that I was doing pretty good and that I was able to handle those panels, you know, and got so I could not just wait to rivet them, but fit them up there and tack them, all sort of things. So then they decided to promote me to an installer, which meant, gosh, I think it was, 10 or 15 cents more an hour.
How long was that after you started?
I don't remember exactly. Let's see. I'm trying to think now exactly how long. Maybe a year.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. A year, maybe. Anyway, then I became an installer. And then...
And what? How was that different?
All right, now the installer, what you do there... the B-17 has already shot up. All those pounds and things that I was learning to, that's all done.
Mm-hmm.
All right, now the next thing, an installer is, for instance, well, you have the wing of the B-17. you're getting ready to join that wing, but there's a fillet, a fairing that has to be fitted to that fuselage, fitted to the contours. See? All right, now somebody had already fitted it to there, but my job is to come along now and drill the holes out and install it. Hmm?
So you would drill the holes out, and would there be some sort of template to do that?
You would have to use your scale, and you would have to measure every inch and a quarter, and you would have to mark with a grease pencil your layout. And while you're doing that, you would also have to observe to see that you were not going to interfere with the longerons in there, because if you had to drill a longeron, you had to be sure you left enough edge distance so you wouldn't drill on the radius or on the edge. So it was a precision thing,
mm-hmm.
and you all hammered it all out, and then after you hammered it out and you drilled it out, then you would clean it out and you would apply ferrocrene, which is a sealant-like thing. It actually, when you riveted the fillet mm-hmm. to the fuselage, it would set up so that no moisture would get inside, no moisture.
Mm-hmm. You
know, like a gasket, more or less. So no moisture would come inside.
Would you do the actual riveting tool? Would you come along and then rivet that?
No, we would do that. We would drill it out, and then my partner and I would work together on that, and we would drill it out and clean it out and set it up, and then we'd rivet it. And then I got my next promotion was a fabricator. My job then was to make that part, the part that we were riveting. I learned how to install the brackets and then fit the metal to the ship. You just custom, every single aircraft is all custom made. Everyone had to be fitted to that doggone ship.
So they would
the wing.
Big sheet metal.
Big sheet metal, and they were all hand, you know, they're all formed, drop hammer parts, big parts, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to learn to hold them up there and tack them and set them, and then they combined our job. We were a fabricator and an installer.
Mm-hmm.
So we fabricated it, made it, and then we riveted it. They combined the two jobs.
So you did the entire process?
The whole thing.
Now, mm-hmm. How long would that process take? So the plane would be, each plane would be moving off every shift?
Well, we got so that we could do that in one shift. We could do that in one shift, you see. But, yes, that's mm-hmm. right. The line would move. And you had to have your work done, because if you didn't, you'd be interfering with the person's next person's job down the line. Just as it is today, it hasn't changed a bit that way.
Well, how did we manage to coordinate in terms of complete? They broke the job down in the time segments that would make it feasible then.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you know, we became more proficient. You know, and especially my partner and I, we were mechanically inclined. We could really knock it out, and we took a lot of pride in that.
Now, was there any time at which you stayed with the same partner for long stretches?
Yes, we would. Uh-huh. And the only thing that would change that is if that person became ill or had to leave or quit or whatever, you know.
Mm-hmm.
See?
Mm-hmm.
And or went on another shift,
yeah.
Because you had three shifts, you know.
Going back to that first day and walking in there and getting your assignment, do you recall, as you were taken over to the D-17, if you felt that there were a large number of women, or if it was mainly men or mainly women, as you first walked in there and were assigned?
Well, I really was truly surprised that there was that many men in there. But I noticed that they were older men, and those who had physical disability, I mean, they could walk, but naturally,
mm-hmm.
you know, they were 4F,
mm-hmm.
you say. And then, of course, as time went on, then the women just, you know, because I was one of the first gals in there in manufacturing, see.
Mm-hmm.
They were hiring women in the previous year, the first part of the year, the previous year, but it was strictly in clerical work, getting a stockroom set up and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But the manufacturing was just new, you see.
Mm-hmm.
So I was surprised to see as many men in there that were, really.
What proportion of women at that point, when you first came in, would you say there were at that point in assembly?
At that point, I would say that probably 80% women,
mm-hmm.
you know, would have gotten down.
Mm-hmm.
Really, maybe 2% men, 90% women. Oh, yeah.
Now, what about things like, obviously with that kind of work, you couldn't do much talking. What about breaks and lunch?
Well, we had a break, but it was not a contractual thing or a law or anything like that, you know. And we would go off and talk, for instance, when my partner and I, when we were fabricating our Phillips, you know, we were outside the aircraft, and we would talk and laugh and that sort of thing. And as long as you got your job done, they didn't say anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they didn't say anything. And, however, there were other people I know that they pushed and pushed and pushed on. They were just not mechanically inclined. It was
mm-hmm.
difficult for them to do their job, you know. And I know my partner and I, we used to help the kids on. We did the one side of the aircraft, and there were two other people who did the other side of the aircraft. So many times we'd go over and help the other crew on the
mm-hmm.
other side, because they no matter how hard they worked, they
mm-hmm.
weren't that adaptable, and so we'd help them out too, you know, because they would put the pressure on those people to get that job done.
Mm-hmm.
They really put the pressure on them. And see, a lot of the people that came out here that worked in the aircraft factory were from out of state and way back from Arkansas on the farm, and that was a lot of money for them. It was a lot of money for me too, but twice as much to them, not that much, and they just wanted it so badly to do right, you know. But a lot of them would never be a mechanic, could never get a job. So it was pretty tough. And I used to feel real sorry for some of those people, because they were afraid to speak up. They were afraid to say
mm-hmm.
anything. They were afraid to say, well, wait a minute now, you're being unfair to me. I'm doing just as good as that person on the other side, you know. And I always thought that was not right.
Mm-hmm.
I really did.
Mm-hmm.
And they were finally, the next promotion for me was, way back then, they had what they called A, B, and C leads. So your C leads was your low man on the totem pole, you know. Your A lead was like a foreman is now.
Mm-hmm.
And
well,
so
what is the difference between those levels?
I'm trying to remember. Well, numbers of people under you you're responsible for, number one, and then there's a difference in pay.
Mm-hmm.
You would get extra pay for that, ten cents an hour more, or whatever.
The C lead, for instance, what was your job?
First of all, this was just before the end of the war, okay? Just before the end of the war. So what they would do, they would take you into the conference rooms, and they would start to train you as to how to teach a man to do a job,
mm.
and how to basic time standard training, that sort of thing, you know. And basic how to keep a chart. progression chart, that sort of thing. And how to keep, it was a completion chart, the progress of the aircraft, amount of work that was completed, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And also, and they teach you how to read what they called project sketches. They were photographs of the aircraft and of an assembly and that sort of thing, and how you were supposed to teach the people how to interpret it to help them build the aircraft better, well, that sort of thing. Well, you know, all up to that point, I used to think it was so terribly unfair the way they used to treat some of the people, because they'd be on them all the time, and they were doing the best they could. And some of them were doing an excellent job, but just because they knew that they could ride them, you know, I used to think it was very unfair. And I thought that naturally, you know, having been an Army brat and having had marvelous medical facilities there and dental and care and all that sort of thing, and there was nothing like that there. And it seemed not right to me that a big organization like that,
mm-hmm.
and surely they were making money, that they couldn't treat the people better, you know. And I became an organizer. That's when I became an organizer for the union. They had people out there that were organizing for the AFL, and of course we did have there were some known communists there too, of mm-hmm. course, and the Progressive Party, and the IAM and the UAW. Well, I talked to some of the people who were organizing for the UAW, and I thought it was a pretty good progressive program and pretty clean, and I liked the things that they promised the people that were going to do.
Do you remember what sorts of things they told?
Well, for instance, they believed, for instance, like I did, there should be a medical plan, there should be a pension plan. I thought it was terrible. These people are going to have to work even for a portion of their life and not get some benefits from that, you see,
mm-hmm.
vested benefits. And the dental plan and vacations and holidays, there was nothing like that. And pay for overtime. There was no pay for overtime there. You were paid straight time.
Yes,
before you even went. See, you should. You
should. 50 cents starting pay.
Yeah, but you should. You should. There should.
So
I thought there should have been compensation. You see. Oh yeah, no vacations, no pension, no nothing. And of course, just because, like I said, coming from a military family where we had those things, I was brought up in all those things. It was so great. I couldn't believe it. Out in the civilian world, it would be like that. You know. So that's the reason why. Okay, your daddy's going to start fighting for those things for the people. Well, that's great. And I believe in seniority. In other words, the person should have a right after you've been there and you're vested right. But you should be entitled to try for the job, even if you couldn't speak up. And came down to your seniority date and your name, you should have a chance to try that job. Because a lot of people, like I say, a lot of them were darn good mechanics, but they didn't know how to speak up for themselves and stand up for their own rights. And I thought that was wrong. See, so.
What were you? Do you remember being approached the first time by the union, or did you just feel humbling?
Well, no. I was unhappy, and I thought it was unfair the way a lot of people were treated, and I expressed my opinion. And so one of the organizers that heard me talking and said, "Well, how about joining UAW?" And I said, "Well, what is your program, you know?" And they told me, and I looked into a lot of it, and I said, "Well, I think that's just great. I'll help you organize." And so, by gosh, I started signing people up, left them, and collecting dues. And, of course, it was all undercover, you know. You had to do everything undercover.
What year would that be? Was that before the election of 44, then?
Right, 43.
And did the IAM approach?
Oh, yes, they sure did. Well, they told me that they had a better program, but I found that I didn't think that they did.
Uh-huh.
And I liked the UAW. I liked Walter Reuther, and I liked everything about him.
Mm-hmm.
His brothers, I liked the whole thing. I liked everything about him. And so I said, no, I felt that the UAW would be better. So I signed people up. I collected dues, 50 cents a month, you know, and I even carried a little receipt book around with me and collected right on the line, up and down the line, all around. You know, I got around pretty good.
And was this when you were already the VP?
No, this was when I was just starting to take the training for it.
Uh-huh.
And in the meantime, about the time for when I was starting to take the training, you know, well, I was making 95 cents an hour. For some time, I was making 95 cents an hour. I finally got to 95 cents an hour. And I said, well, when am I going to be making a dollar an hour? Oh, well, you know, rivers don't make a dollar an hour. And I said, well, but I've been here. Am I not doing the job? Yes. I said, well, then why can I not make a dollar an hour? And I kept after him, you know. I really did. And by gosh, one day they took me outside the building. And they said, now, Elizabeth, we're going to give you a dollar an hour, but we don't want you to tell anybody on the line about this. You're the only one. And so we're going to give you a dollar an hour. I said, fine. So as soon as I got my first check, oh, I'm telling you, I really organized then. Because there are people out there who are even better mechanically than I was, really. But they just didn't know how to speak up for themselves,
mm-hmm.
and stand up for their rights, you know. And that's not right.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't right. It still isn't right. And so anyway, I felt that's why I felt the need to really get in there and organize a good union.
Mm-hmm.
And
Can you describe what sort of techniques you would use to try and get people to sign up, Betty? What would you talk to them about?
Well,
what would you do it where?
For instance, right on the job, mm-hmm. on the line, and whenever I could, in the restrooms, whatever, you know? And, of course, now on our breaks, I did a lot of signing up on the breaks. That was out in the open.
Mm-hmm.
But if I happened to be, like, on the inside bucking that day and someone on the side was really, really having a hard time and the boss was really on about something, you know, I'd say, well, look, if we had a union, you know, we could do something about this. We could talk about it. You know, if you're unjustly treated, call your representative. And then you have someone speak for you. You don't have to go out there and fight your battle, you know. You pay dues for representation, and that's how you do these things. And also, you know, we worked hard, long hours. Oh, you know, I can remember being so tired. I'm not kidding you. My daughter mentioned it the last time I was up in Montana, this last May. She says, yeah, Mom, I remember one time you came home and you were eating your dinner and you actually put your head down the table and I fell asleep. I was young. I was in my early 20s. We worked hard, you know. We really did. But things like no vacations. No overtime like that, and time off. Oh boy, really tough to get time off and things like that. And that mainly the people were not getting paid for what the work they were doing, compensable things. They were not. It just wasn't right. Like I say, why should I get paid $1 an hour? And people out there that have doing just as to the best of their ability. Okay,
mm-hmm.
There's no reason why they shouldn't get paid the same thing.
Now, in trying to organize and sign people up. Did you have to contend with explaining what the differences were then between the IAM and UAW? So
yes.
They were already...
Well, yes, they were. They started organizing, reorganizing, believe it or not, just a week or so after... for instance, this may be interesting to you. One of the fellows I married, he hired in a week after I did, and he was an organizer. He was being paid by the IAM to organize. I didn't know this, of course. So they had people in there that they were on payroll. They were doing this organizing. And I would talk to them about some of their programs that I don't recall exactly any of the specific things that were plus or minus about that, but I remember that I was sufficiently happy with the UAW that I stayed with it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I continued to organize.
Yeah. But I was just wondering primarily in terms of, it seems like there'd be a real difference between trying to convince someone about a union, period, versus trying to convince them of this one versus that one.
A comparison, right. Uh-huh. Yes, now you see, if you were to ask me that question now,
mm-hmm.
about something that hasn't been that many years ago,
yeah.
For instance, I could say that, for instance, like when I was in the bargaining committee for UAW, it was quite a chore for us, especially when our contracts expired first, to negotiate and to get the IAM to coordinate with us. For instance, we say, now we're going to go for 10 cents more an hour on this particular job, on a job in equity, and get them to go along that when their negotiations come up, that they would go along with it, they'd push for it too.
Mm.
Because if we didn't get this first time, we'd try again the next time around.
Mm-hmm.
But in the meantime, we would expect the IAM to get in there and push for it when their contract negotiations had expired.
For
the same level, that's right, like Santa Monica,
mm-hmm.
and El Segundo.
Yeah,
you see,
yeah.
And they weren't as progressive. They weren't as militant as we were. They were more business agent type thing. And see, all of our representatives are elected people from the shop. They're
mm-hmm.
all people from the shop.
Mm-hmm.
So you're really close to the job, you know,
mm-hmm.
and you answer close to the job. You don't sit up there in an office
yeah.
all this time. You know, the only people that we have, they're full time officers. As far as our president. And our financial secretary, and that's really all supposed to be. But now we have, because of the volume of work we have, and the work's become so much more complex over the years, of pension plans,
mm-hmm.
and your Social Security, and good Lord, and our editor's full time too. And but now we have our president, vice president, our recording secretary is full time, financial secretary. Let's see, and our editor and assistant editor's up there most of the time too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because we have pretty big paper and a lot of responsibility.
Do you recall, as things led up to the election and then the runoff and all of that, do you recall those events?
Oh, my. Yes, I was an observer at the election. Actually, I worked so hard and everything,
mm-hmm.
you know. And it was quite a battle. They they fought pretty hard. I mean, they'd pull some dirty tricks, you know, how when you get a person signed up, you know, then they'd try to convince the person that they shouldn't be with UWIM, and they'd come back and try to get asking for their card back, and I would have to go through all that kind of stuff, you know. So it was a kind of a hassle right down to the very end. So after the election, you know, we thought it was all over because that's it, period. And after the NLRB election, and then so finally, people like Ernie West, later married, he became active in the UAW. He joined the UAW. Oh yeah, he joined the UAW, so he got in there.
Wasn't it contested, and there was a second election?
No, not for the voting rights. We may have had a contested election for a section of a group bringing him into the bargaining unit. Might have been.
The end of January of 44, and in February, the UAW won in a runoff.
That could be. I don't recall that part of it. That could be. As far as any being contested, no. Mm-hmm. The only thing I can remember is that one time that we had a group that withdrew from our union during the escape clause of our contract, mm-hmm. you know, and that was very bad.
Can you tell me how that was? This was all still under this maintenance of membership agreement during
mm-hmm.
the war period, wasn't
mm-hmm,
it?
Yeah.
How did that work exactly in terms of when you would sign someone up after the election was won?
Mm-hmm.
They would have to indicate that they were going to stay in the union in order for them not to be dropped.
Let's see if I understand you.
You're
talking about those people who had signed up.
Yeah, this maintenance of membership has me very confused in terms of exactly how it worked under those clauses. So say once the election was won, and then you signed up somebody.
Right, uh-huh.
And your unit.
Uh-huh.
Now, in order to stay in the union, they then had to indicate intent after a certain time period, or they automatically were able.
I think you're automatically a member, because when you sign that card, when you sign that little card, just that you're accepted
mm-hmm.
as a member.
Mm-hmm.
You're accepted as a member. We still have them on. My God, we still have some up there, and filing up in the hall,
mm-hmm.
way back.
Mm-hmm.
Because once you sign up, that's it. And once you sign up, but then what they did, those people. As the new members came in right in the beginning, you attend a membership meeting, and then you're sworn in, accepted, and all that sort of thing, see? And so once you sign that card, that's it.
Mm-hmm.
And your maintenance of membership, you had dues check off.
Mm-hmm.
Where so that, however, at that time, you didn't have to belong to the union.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and now you must either pay dues or pay to a charitable organization, you know, mm-hmm. in the union's name or whatever, see?
Tell me a little bit more about the course of the work day, say, beginning when you were a riveter, in terms of your own, you were all living in this apartment now
mm-hmm.
on Orange,
mm-hmm.
and how would your day start out going to work and all the way through the job break when you get home, if you could sort of describe in the very early, the beginning,
yes.
what
mm-hmm.
your day would be like?
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, we still had... my younger brother was still living at home. No, he was already at sea then. Just my sister, my baby sister, and my older sisters had been married by then. Just my younger sister and Mary Beth. So what I would do, you know, like when I get in the morning, I would more or less see that their clothes were ready for school and things like that, you know, and make lunches or whatever had been like that. Then I would get myself ready and I would go because I would have to leave early. I would have to leave. Well. As I recall, it would be about 5:45 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'd, you know, get up to in order to start at 7 o'clock. And then my dad and the girls, my little sister and little Rosemary, they would take care of themselves, you know, get dressed and have breakfast and go to school.
Mm-hmm.
And then usually they were home by the time I got home from work.
Mm-hmm.
Because school was not very far from there. They could walk. It was very nice, very
mm-hmm.
convenient, you know. So then I was home. And then I'd come home and I'd cook dinner.
Well, then what would happen? You'd go in a carpool.
To
the factory.
Right.
Uh-huh.
Right. I would, eventually I got into a carpool, which was so much better because the buses were so crowded. Oh, boy, were they crowded. Reminds me of like the cable car, you know, in San Francisco. People just stuffed in there, hanging outside and everything else. Anyway, so I got in a carpool, and we paid so much a week and went to work. And then we'd get in there in the morning, and we had to, there was a third shift in there, of course, and we would have to stand aside and wait, you know, until people were whistle-blowing out of the way. Then we'd immediately get in there and start to work right away. And depending upon the job you had, now, we had the job, like my partner and I, we were the fillet job, the wing fillet. That was something we could complete in one day. But then eventually I got moved to a more highly skill job, or took more skill, and it was a pickup on the line. And what you would do when the aircraft got down to a certain end of the line here, almost, say, two positions from the final, they're joining, they would go in and they would call what they call shakedown. The inspection would go over the whole plane. And if they find anything wrong, they would write up a squawk, okay? So then the pickup crew would come along and get a squawk sheet, and you would go and you correct all these errors. You would have to, and even to the point of fabricating some parts. I mean, like getting a if there was a cannon in the area, all right, then you would get your different extrusion, and you would fit it and file it and the whole thing and make it into a part and install it, you know. Or if you had something inside where they had a bolt that was too long or too short or whatever, then you would remove and replace that. Or rivets that were bad, if you had to go oversized, or you would work tags and engineering items.
Now, you would then have to drill out the rivet yourself.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you would fix all of these very bad boo-boos, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So that's what I actually, when the war was over, and I know that... that's what I was doing. I was doing pickup and installation of instrument brackets and things like that, where you'd have to learn to use a little level.
Mm-hmm.
You start to install your bracket, you put your little level there, so before you, like that, before you drill the hole, you know, it had to be absolutely straight. Mm-hmm. Drill your hole, and then put a bolt or whatever in.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it you do by yourself.
Yeah.
You know, do by yourself, because it's a very small area there, so you had to do both. You had to shoot and buck a rivet like that, or else install a bolt and nut, whatever. Mm-hmm. And I remember how heartbroken I was when finally they laid people off, and finally got down to just a skeleton crew, and I was one of the skeleton crews, and those B-17s that we were working on were going to be scrapped. Just absolutely crushed, you know.
Was this after, at what point was this? Was this after VE Day?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, oh, how terrible. How terrible. But we worked on those things just as if they were going to fly any minute, you know, mm-hmm. go out the door and fly.
But you were working on the craft knowing it was about to be scrapped.
Yes, we sure did.
Now, I want to get back to what your daily schedule was like, while we're on this. At what point do you recall the layoffs beginning?
Well, it was right after VJ Day,
mm-hmm.
you know. And they went out in groves. My goodness, I remember how instead of moving a B-17, we had two lines.
Mm-hmm.
And so instead of moving the B-17 down the one line right adjacent to the wall, there was no B-17 there, and they set up ropes, you know, just like big corrals, and they had people come in according to your employee number, bring your toolbox up and put it here, and then turn your badge in, your ID in, you know, then they would give you a little note, little slip saying that you were now laid off and that your check would be mailed to you, say,
mm-hmm.
and it was just heartbreaking to see some of those people. A lot of them thought, you know, a lot of them didn't know what they were going to do, whether they were going to remain in the aircraft or go back to the farm or what, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was kind of sad.
As the layoffs, there were some earlier layoffs in 44, weren't there?
I don't remember.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember.
Well, as the layoffs began, what did you think would happen to you?
Well, I wasn't sure because I hadn't been able to save a whole lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, first of all, let me tell you one thing here now. My little brother, the younger brother that was in the maritime service, he had a little 36 Ford, and so he left it at home with us when he finally went to the war. And so I finally was used, instead of taking the carpool, I would drive, and I got a C sticker, and I would take riders with me.
Mm-hmm.
And the pressure, the landlord started telling us that we would have to move out of that apartment, three-bedroom apartment, because he wanted it for himself. So we were having a really hard time finding any place. So what I did In the meantime, I got married. I married a fellow. Oh, Lord, I'm sorry. Boy, I'm really getting ahead of myself.
No, that's okay. It's, I know it's, you know,
it's
thoughts are blessing. Yeah, I've got notes. I know where we need to go. Don't worry about that.
Okay. Okay.
Well, maybe what we should do then is go.
Let's go back to.
Go back to.
Kind of what year it was, even for heaven's sake. I've got to stop and think.
Well, if we move up to it, maybe it'll come back. How about, we were talking about when you come in on the ship, and the other ship would be leaving. Maybe let's start.
Okay.
Start back there again. In the very, very beginning, your early jobs. So you come in and stuff.